After they had delivered Private Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter, to the small rescue column that would return him to base, Sergeants Jeff McLaughlin and Casey Joyce had set off north on Holwoodig to rejoin their element, Chalk 4. They hadn't gotten far. They were distracted by a gunman down on an alley who would pop out to shoot and then duck back before they could return fire. McLaughlin was determined to get him. He grew so absorbed in this fruitless duel that he lost track of time and place and was startled when a platoon sergeant yelled his name. "Hey, Mac, come on!" The convoy was moving on the street behind him. Everybody seemed to be on it except him. He looked over for Joyce and he was gone too. He had already climbed into a vehicle. McLaughlin crossed the road and trotted along the far side of one Humvee, past the contested alley. The Humvee was full. McLaughlin insisted that Private Torrey Carlson shove over. Carlson did, and McLaughlin crawled on the seat and set his M16 on the rim of the open right rear window. About 100 yards farther up, the convoy came upon the remainder of Sergeant Eversman's beleaguered Chalk 4. Eversman and his men had been pinned down since the time Blackburn fell from the chopper. The convoy arrived like an answer to Eversman's liftoff Hail Mary. McKnight was in the lead Humvee and shouted,
"Hey, Sergeant, get in! We're driving to the crash site!"
The chalk leader herded his men aboard the crowded vehicles, loading the wounded first. McKnight shouted for him to hurry up. The column was rolling again. Nobody in the rear vehicles knew where they were going. Many of the men didn't know that a helicopter had been shot down. One who did not was Eric Spaulding, who was in the passenger seat in the cab of the second truck, the one with the prisoners. Driving was Specialist John Maddox. They had the front windshield flipped up and out so Spaulding could shoot forward. He leaned his M16 out the truck window. There were too many targets, too many people shooting at him. It was as if Kill an American Day had been declared in Moog. When the column took a turn to the right, he wondered what was up. "The mission is over. Why aren't we going back?" After going 2 blocks east, the convoy made another right turn. They'd lost track of the men moving to the crash site on foot. A woman in a flowing purple robe darted past on the driver's side of the truck. Maddox had his pistol resting on his left arm, pretty much shooting at whatever moved.
"Don't shoot," Spaulding shouted. "She's got a kid."
The woman abruptly turned. Holding the baby in one arm, she raised a pistol with her free hand. Spaulding shot her where she stood. He shot 4 more rounds into her before she fell. He hoped he hadn't hit the baby. He thought he probably had. Why would a mother do something like that with a kid on her arm? What was she thinking? Spaulding couldn't get over it. Maybe she was just trying to get away, saw the truck, panicked, and raised the gun. There wasn't time to fret over it. Black Hawk pilot Mike Durant had seen a little bird ascend from the crash site as he swung Super 6-4 back south on its holding pattern. Then he heard the expected radio call for Super 6-8, the combat search and rescue Blackhawk. His own summons from Lieutenant Colonel Matthews and the command bird came moments later over the radio. 6-4, come up and join 6-2 in his orbit. Durant replied, 6-4 is inbound. Moving in fast and low over the city, Durant caught glimpses of the action beneath the chopper's chin bubble. The neat box structure they had outlined earlier with rangers positioned on all 4 corners of the target block had completely broken down. He could see the general area where Elvis's bird had gone in, a dense neighborhood of small stone houses with tin roofs, in a crosshatch of dirt alleys and wide cross streets, but the crashed Blackhawk was in such a tight spot between houses he couldn't see it. He caught glimpses of small ranger columns moving up the dusty alleys, exchanging fire with the swarms of Somalis who were also running in that direction. Durant fell into Elvis's vacant place in a circular pattern opposite Super 6-2, the Blackhawk piloted by Chief Warrant Officer Mike Gothina and Captain Jim Yacone, and Durant began trying to get in sync with them. The idea was to maintain a sweeping circle over the battle area. On the radio, Durant heard that the combat search and rescue bird had been hit, but had managed to rope in the rescue team and was still flying. It was on his 4th or 5th circle that he felt his chopper hit something, hard, like an invisible speed bump. Blackhawk pilot Mike Gofina was coming up behind Mike Durant's Super 6-4 when the grenade hit. It blew a chunk off the tail rotor. Gofina saw all the oil dump out of it in a fine mist, but the mechanism stayed intact, and everything seemed to still be functioning. Kafina asked, 6-4, are you okay? The Black Hawk is a heavy aircraft. Durant's weighed about 16,000 pounds at that point, and the tail rotor was a long way from where he sat. The question came before he had even figured out what happened. Kafina explained that he'd been hit by an RPG and that there was damage to the tail area. Durant radioed back coolly, Roger? Nothing felt abnormal about the bird at first. The sturdy Black Hawk was built to run without oil for a time if necessary, and it was still holding steady. Matthews, the air mission commander, had also seen the hit from his seat in the orbiting command bird. He told Durant to put the Black Hawk on the ground, so Durant pointed back to the airfield, about a 4-minute flight southwest. He could see the base off in the distance against the coastline. Kafina followed Durant for about a mile to a point where he felt confident Super 6-4 would make it back. He had just started to turn back when Durant's tail rotor, the whole thing, the gearbox and 2 or 3 feet of the vertical fin assembly, just turned into a blur and evaporated. Inside Super 6-4, Durant and co-pilot Ray Frank felt the airframe begin to vibrate. They heard the accelerating high-speed whine of the dry gear shaft in its death throes. Then came a very loud bang as it blew apart. The bird began to spin. Details of earth and sky blurred like patterns on a spinning top. Frank had the presence of mind to do exactly the right thing. The power control levers for the machines were on the ceiling of the cockpit. Frank had to fight the spin's strong centrifugal force to raise his arms. In those frantic seconds, he somehow managed to pull one lever back, shutting off one engine, and to pull the other one halfway back. Durant shouted into his radio, "Going in hard! Going down! Ray!" The plummeting helicopter's spin rate suddenly slowed. Just before impact, its nose pulled up. With the spin rate down to half what it had been, and with the craft fairly level, the Black Hawk made a hard but flat landing. Flat was critical. It meant there was a chance the men in the helicopter were still alive. Youssef Dahir Moalim was near the man who fired the grenade. Moalim ducked behind the tree to hide from the Black Hawk overhead. As he did, one of his men dropped to one knee in the middle of the alley and pointed up his Russian anti-tank weapon. The tube had been fitted with a metal funnel, which was welded on the back end at an angle to direct the backblast away from the shooter's body. Moalim shouted, "If you miss, I've got another round." They were veteran fighters, guns for hire mostly, although everybody was now fighting the Americans for free. Moalim's father had died in 1984 in fighting between Somalia and Ethiopia, and at age 15, the son was recruited to take his place. He was a skeletal young man, lost in oversized shirt and pants. His village was a labyrinth of twisting cactus-lined dirt paths around rag huts and tin-roofed shanties, just south of the Bakara market area. He had organized the men there into an irregular militia for hire. They remained primarily allied to Aidid, because they belonged, as Aidid did, to the Haber Gider clan. Mainly, they defended their village from other marauding bands of young fighters. They took payment for their services in rice or kat. The drug took its toll. Another word for the Morian was dai-dai, or quick-quick, for their jumpy ways and nervous tics. They were fearless fighters, and they often died young. But these days, all the Morian in southern Mogadishu had a common enemy. Some had begun calling themselves, in a play on the word rangers, revengers. To Aidid's fighters, the rangers' weakness was apparent. They were not willing to die. Somalis were famous for braving enemy fire, for almost suicidal frontal assaults. They were brought up in clans and named for their fathers and grandfathers. They entered a fight with cunning and courage and gave themselves over to the savage emotion of it. Retreat, even before overwhelming enemy fire, was considered unmanly. For the clan, they were always ready to die. To kill rangers, you had to make them stand and fight. The answer was to bring down a helicopter. The rangers would move to protect its crew. They would establish a perimeter and wait for help. They would probably not be overrun, but they could be made to bleed and die. It seemed to Moalim that the helicopter crashed very slowly, It flew on for a while like it had not been damaged, and then abruptly tilted forward and started to spin. It fell in Wat Digley, a crowded neighborhood just south of his own. The crash brought cries of exultation from the crowd. All around him, Maulim saw people reverse direction. Moments before, the crowd and the fighters had been moving north toward the Olympic Hotel and to where the first Black Hawk had crashed. Now, everyone around him was racing south. He ran with them. The smell of blood was in the air. In ordinary circumstances, as close to the first crash as they were, the convoy would have just barreled over to it. But with all the help overhead, Task Force Ranger was about to demonstrate how too much information can hurt soldiers on a battlefield. High in the command and control Black Hawk, Harrell and Matthews could see roadblocks in places where Somalis had massed to ambush, so they steered the convoy away from those places. There was an added complication. Flying about 1,000 feet over the command helicopter was the Navy Orion spy plane, which had surveillance cameras that gave them a clear picture of the convoy's predicament. But the Orion pilots were handicapped. They were not allowed to communicate directly with the convoy. Their directions relayed to the commander of the Joint Operations Center, who would then radio Harrell in the command bird. Only then was the plane's advice relayed down to the convoy. This built in a maddening delay. The Orion pilots would see a direct line to the crash site. They'd say, "Turn left." But by the time that instruction reached Colonel Danny McKnight in the lead Humvee, he had passed the turn. The convoy was bearing south when Durant's helicopter crashed. Up in the lead Humvee, McKnight got the word on the radio from Lieutenant Colonel Harrell. "Danny, we just had another Hawk go down to RPG fire south of the Olympic Hotel. Try to get everyone off that crash site, and let's get out of here down to the other Hawk and secure it." It wasn't going to be easy. McKnight was supposed to take this convoy with the prisoners and the wounded, move to the first crash site, and link up with the bulk of the force there. There was not enough room on the packed Humvees and trucks for the men he already had. Yet the immediate plan called for the convoy to load everyone and proceed south to the second crash site, covering the same treacherous ground they were rolling through now. They pushed on. As they passed back behind the target house, an RPG scored a direct hit on the third Humvee in the column, the one Sergeant Jeff McLaughlin had squeezed into. The grenade cut straight through the steel skin of the vehicle in front of the gas cap and went off inside, blowing the three men in back right out to the street. It tore the handguards off McLaughlin's weapon and pierced his left forearm with a chunk of shrapnel. Holding his breath in the dark cloud, his ears ringing, Private Tory Carlson felt himself for wet spots. His left arm was bloody. Shrapnel had pierced it in several places. His boots were on fire. A drum of 50 cal ammo had been hit, and he heard people screaming for him to kick it out.
"Kick it out!"
Which he did, then stooped to pat out the flames on his feet. Two of the three men blown out the back were severely injured. One, Delta Master Sergeant Tim Grizz Martin, had absorbed the brunt of the blast. The grenade had poked a football-sized hole right through the skin of the Humvee, blew on through the sandbags, through Martin, and penetrated the ammo can. It had blown off the lower half of Martin's body. The explosion also tore off the back end of one of Private Adalberto Rodriguez's thighs. Rodriguez had tumbled about 10 yards before coming to rest. His legs were a mass of blood and gore. He began struggling to his feet, only to see one of the 5-ton trucks bearing straight for him, its driver, Private Maddox, momentarily disoriented by another grenade blast, rolled the truck right over him. The convoy stopped and soldiers scrambled to pick up the wounded. Medics did what they could for Rodriguez and Martin. The wounded were lifted back into the vehicles, while Rangers spilled out to cover the surrounding streets and alleys. At opposite ends of one alley, Specialist Aaron Hand and Sergeant Casey Joyce became engaged in a furious firefight. Joyce was on one knee facing north. He had found cover and was returning disciplined fire, just the way he'd been taught, when a gun barrel poked from a window above and behind him and let off a quick burst. Carlson saw it happen. Joyce went straight down in the dirt, on his face. Sergeant Jim Telsher, ignoring the heavy fire, sprinted out to Joyce, grabbed him by the shirt and vest, and without even slowing down, dragged him back to the column. Joyce's skin was already gray, and his eyes were open wide and rolled back so you could see only the whites. He had been hit in the upper back where the Rangers' new Kevlar flak vests had no protective plate. They loaded him in on the back of a Humvee, where a Delta medic went to work on him frantically, holding an IV bag up high with one hand, despairing, "We've got to get him back in a hurry. We've got to get him back in a hurry, or he's going to die." The convoy lurched forward again, but the gunfire was relentless. Up in the lead Humvee, Lieutenant Colonel McKnight was hit. Shrapnel cut into his right arm and the left side of his neck. In the convoy's second-to-last Humvee, Sergeant Lorenzo Ruiz, a tough little boxer from El Paso who had taken over Private Clay Othick's 50-caliber machine gun after Othick had been hit in the arm, slumped and slid down, limp, into the laps of the men inside the Humvee. With Ruiz now on top of them, no one could climb into the turret from inside, so Specialist Dave Ritchie got out and jumped up on the turret from the outside. He couldn't lower himself into it because Ruiz's limp body was blocking it. So he leaned in from the outside as they began moving again, swiveling and shooting the big gun, hanging on to avoid being thrown to the street. Inside, they pulled Ruiz down to let Ritchie get behind the gun. The volume of fire was terrifying, yet Somalis seemed to be darting across streets everywhere. At the rear of the convoy, where Ruiz was fighting for his life, Sergeant John Burns couldn't get through to McKnight on the radio, so he took off on foot. He made it up to McKnight, who was bloody and busy on the radio. So Burns told Sergeant Bob Gallagher about Ruiz. Burns thought they should allow a Humvee or two to speed right back to the base with the wounded man, as they had done earlier with Blackburn. But Gallagher knew the convoy could not afford to lose any more vehicles and firepower. He told Burns there was no way anybody was leaving. "We have to move to the crash site and consolidate forces." Disgusted, Burns began to make his way back down to the column to his vehicle. He had only gone a few steps when the convoy started rolling again. He jumped on the back of a Humvee. It was already jammed. The rear of the vehicle was slick and sticky with blood. Moaning rose from the pile of Rangers. Beside him, Joyce looked dead, even though a medic was still working on him. Sergeant Galantine was screaming, "My thumb's shot off! My thumb's shot off!" Burns did not want to be on that Humvee. Not long after Private Carlson saw Joyce shot, which really shook him up, he felt a sudden blow and sharp pain in his right knee. It felt like someone had taken a knife and held it to his knee and then driven it in with a sledgehammer. He glanced down to see blood rapidly staining his pants. He said a prayer and kept shooting. He had been wildly scared for longer than he had ever felt in his life, and now, he thought, he might literally die of fright. His heart banged in his chest and he found it hard to breathe. He figured, "This is it for me." And then, in that moment of maximum terror, he felt it all abruptly, inexplicably, fall away. One second he was paralyzed with fear and pain, and the next, he had stopped caring about himself. All that did matter were his buddies, his brothers, that they not get hurt, that they not get killed. These men around him were more important to him than life itself. It was like when Telscher ran out on the road to pull Joyce back in. Carlson understood that now, and it was heroic, but it also wasn't heroic. At a certain level, he knew Telscher had made no choice, just as he was not choosing to be unafraid. It had just happened to him, like he had passed through some barrier. He had to keep fighting, because the other guys needed him. The convoy continued north for about 9 blocks. They'd gone past the crash site only a block west of it without stopping. The helicopters had directed them to turn right, but the alleyways looked too narrow to Dan Schilling and the others in the lead Humvee. If the trucks got stuck, they'd probably all be killed. So they continued on. Sergeant Dan Schilling fought back feelings of futility. McKnight seemed dazed and overwhelmed. He was bleeding from the arm and the neck and not his usual decisive self. Schilling then decided to do something. He bypassed the command Blackhawk and contacted the observation helicopters flying orbits higher up. He asked them to vector him to the crash site. The choppers told him to steer the convoy west on Armed Forces Street and then hang another left. They made the left turn off Armed Forces and drove through the storm of gunfire for about 7 blocks before Schilling saw up ahead the smoldering remains of the 5-ton truck they had torched in front of the target building. They'd come full circle. Schilling hadn't told the observation bird pilots which crash site he wanted. The pilots could see how desperate things were around Durant's crash, where Somali mobs had begun to encircle the unprotected, downed Black Hawk. "We're headed for the second crash site," he told McKnight. The lieutenant colonel knew only what his orders were. He reiterated that they were to proceed to the first crash site. So the convoy now made a U-turn. They had just driven through a vicious ambush in front of the target house and were now turning around to drive right back through it. Men in the vehicles behind could not understand. It was insane. They seemed to be trying to get killed. Things had deteriorated so badly that up in the command bird, Harrell was considering just releasing the prisoners, their prize, the supposed point of this mission, and of all this carnage. He instructed the Delta units on foot now closing in on the first crash site.
"As soon as you get linked up with the uniform element, throw all the precious cargo. We're going to try and get forced down to the second crash site."
At every intersection now, Somalis just lined up on both sides of the street and fired at every vehicle that came across. The city was shredding them, block by block. They were America's elite fighters, and they were going to die here, outnumbered by this determined rabble. Their future was setting with this sun on this day and in this place. Schilling felt disbelief and now some guilt. He had steered the convoy the wrong way for at least part of this calamity. Stunned by the confusion, he struggled to convince himself this was all really happening. Over and over he muttered, "We're going to keep driving around until we're all fucking dead." Specialist Eric Spaulding was still behind the passenger door in the second truck with his rifle out the window when he was startled by a flash of light down by his legs. It looked like a laser beam shot through the door and up into his right leg. A bullet had pierced the steel of the door and the window, which was rolled down, and had poked itself and fragments of glass and steel straight up his leg from just above his knee all the way up to his hip. He squealed. Maddox shouted,
"What's wrong? You hit?" "Yes!" cried Spaulding.
And then another laser poked through, this one into his left leg. Spaulding felt a jolt this time, but no pain. Then Maddox shouted,
I can't see! I can't see!"
The driver's helmet was askew and his glasses were knocked around sideways on his head.
"Put your glasses on, you dumbass," Spaulding said.
But Maddox had been hit in the back of the head. The round must have hit his helmet, which saved his life, but hit with such force that it had rendered him temporarily blind. The truck was rolling out of control and Spaulding, with both legs shot, couldn't move over to grab the wheel. They couldn't stop in the field of fire, so there was nothing to do but shout directions to Maddox. The truck was weaving and banging into the sides of buildings. It ran over a Somali man on crutches.
"What was that?" asked Maddox. "Don't worry about it," said Spaulding. "We just ran over somebody."
And they laughed. They felt no pity and were beyond fear. They were both laughing as Maddox stopped the truck. One of the D-boys, Sergeant Mike Foreman, jumped from the back of the truck, ran up, and opened the driver's side door to a cabin now splattered with blood.
"Holy shit!"
Maddox slid over next to Spaulding, who was now preoccupied with his wounds. Spaulding propped both legs up on the dash and pressed a field dressing on one. He lay his rifle on the rim of the side window, changed the magazine, and, as Foreman got the truck moving again, resumed firing. He was shooting at everything that moved. To make room for wounded on the back of his Humvee, wounded Private Clay Othick, who had been shot in the arm at the beginning of the fight, jumped out the back and ran to the second truck. One of the men riding there proffered a hand to help him climb aboard, but with his broken arm, Othick couldn't grab hold of anything. After several failed attempts, he ran around to the cab, and Specialist Aaron Hand stepped out to let him squeeze up in between himself and the driver, Private Richard Kovalevsky, a skinny, quiet kid from Texas whom they all called Alphabet because they didn't want to pronounce his name. Kovalevsky was new to the unit and quiet. He had just met a girl he wanted to marry and had been talking about leaving the regiment when his tour was up in a few months. Minutes after Othick slid in next to him, Kovalevsky was hit by a bullet in his shoulder, which knocked him back against the seat. He checked out the wound briefly and straightened back up behind the wheel. "Alphabet, want me to drive?" asked Othick. "No, I'm okay." Othick was struggling in the confined space to apply a pressure dressing to the driver's bleeding shoulder when the RPG hit. It rocketed in from the left, severing Kovalevsky's left arm and entering his chest. It didn't explode. The 2-foot-long missile embedded itself in Kovalevsky, the fins sticking out his left side under his missing arm, the point sticking out the right side. He was unconscious, but still alive. Driverless, the truck crashed into the back end of the one before it. Othick had been knocked cold. He awakened a specialist hand shaking him, yelling that he had to get out.
"It's on fire!"
The cab was black with smoke, and Othick could see the rocket fuse glowing from what looked like inside Alphabet. The grenade lodged in his chest was unexploded, but something had caused a blast. It might have been a flashbang mounted on Kovalevsky's vest or rocket propellant from the grenade. Hand jumped out of his door. Othick reached over to grab Kovalevsky and pull him out, but the driver's bloody clothes just lifted damply off his pierced torso. Othick stumbled out to the street and noticed his and Hand's helmets had been blown off. Hand's rifle was shattered. Hand also found the lower portion of Kovalevsky's arm, just the left hand and a bit of wrist. He picked it up, ran back to the Humvee where the D-boys had placed Kovalevsky, and put it in the mortally wounded man's pants pocket. Still dazed, Othick crawled into a Humvee. As they set off again, he began groping on the floor with his good left hand collecting rounds that guys had ejected from their weapons when they jammed. Othick passed them back to those still shooting. Many of the vehicles were running out of ammo. They had expended thousands of rounds. 3 of the 24 Somali prisoners were dead and 1 was wounded. The back ends of the remaining trucks and Humvees were slick with blood. There were chunks of viscera clinging to floors and inner walls. McKnight's lead Humvee had 2 flat tires, both on the right side. The vehicles were meant to run on flats, but at nowhere near normal speed. The second Humvee in line was almost totally disabled. It was dragging an axle and was being pushed by the 5-ton behind it, the one that had been hit by the grenade that killed Kovalevsky. They had been wandering now for about 45 minutes. McKnight was ready to pack it in. There were now far more dead and wounded in the convoy than there were at the first crash site. He called up to Harrell.
"We've got a lot of vehicles that will be almost impossible to move. Quite a few casualties. Getting to the crash site will be awful tough. Are pinned down."
Harrell was insistent.
"Danny, I really need to get you back to that crash site. What's your status?"
But McKnight and his men had had enough.
"I have numerous casualties. Vehicles that are halfway running. Gotta get these casualties out of here. ASAP.
They began moving, everyone heartened as word passed back that they were finally pointed back to the base. Maybe some of them would make it out alive, after all. They found Via Lenin, a 4-lane road that would lead them back down to the K4 traffic circle and home. It was 5:40 p.m. Of the approximately 75 men in the convoy, soldiers and prisoners, nearly half had been hit by bullets or shrapnel. 8 were dead or near death. As they approached the K4 circle, they braced themselves for another vicious ambush.